And I know that the Secretary of State is on the line, and I'm here. Is the Treasurer on now?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Oh, good. Hi, Matt. Then our first order of business is the approval of the minutes from the March 6th meeting, and those were distributed along with the agenda. I'll make a motion to approve.
I'll second it, Doug.
Any discussion about the minutes? Then all in favor of approval, say aye.
Hi, Doug.
Hi, Matt.
Hi, Brad. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, could we move to routine business and skip new business so that we can come back and finish the business of the meeting?
We should approve the loans.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
I apologize.
Then, it's okay. We have,
okay,
we have six loans.
Down there.
We have six loans here.
Yep, six loans for about $3.3 million. Have they been approved for proper public purpose?
They have, Mr. Chairman.
Then I'll make a motion to approve them.
I'll second the motion.
Then any discussion regarding these loans this month? Okay. Then I'll call for the vote. All in favor of approval, say aye. Aye, Brad.
Aye, Doug.
Matt, I'll vote no.
Okay. Then we will. Well, we don't have any old business, and then we have the new business. Jonathan, were you suggesting we start with the venture investors now, or did you want to just wrap up the executive secretary's report first?
What I want to do is just wrap up the business of the meeting and then come back to the venture investors, and I'll make it easy.
All right.
The transaction report is very skinny, and I don't have anything to add today because I want to get right to the presentation. So my report is concluded.
Okay. Are there any future agenda items anyone wants to raise? With that, then, we can move to the presentation by venture investors, please.
Great.
Let's see.
Let me make a comment. There we go. We have we have a full board meeting here, or at least two. We will continue this as an official board meeting, but with no anticipation of any additional action, just hearing out the presentation.
Want to turn
great.
Off the turn them? Keep it going.
Just over there.
I think you have to use the main name.
All right. Well, good afternoon. I'm John Nice. I'm Managing Director of Venture Investors, and I'm here with two of my colleagues, Paul Weiss and David Arnstein, and appreciate the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about Venture Investors, our history, and our plans for our sixth fund. So I'll dispense with the safe harbor statement. It is here in the presentation. So who we are, we're a leader in taking healthcare innovations from Midwestern research universities to high-value exits.
Can I interrupt? I apologize for being out of the loop maybe, Jonathan, but can you, in a couple sentences, tell me exactly why we had this presentation today?
If you may recall, we had a presentation some months ago from the 4490 investor group. And they were an investor group that was focused on a different area, primarily software in IT. And this is a venture capital group that's been, at least we perceive, is focused on biologic enterprises. And they're tied very closely with research universities in the region. So it's another avenue for us to potentially make investments in a venture capital venue. So just as we did with the 4490, Doug, we thought it appropriate to give the board a chance to hear from the principals of the investment fund.
So we would potentially invest $10, $20, $30 million.
Not quite that much. Maybe they'd like that.
I'd like to throw some
deposit. Oh, great. I think they like the 30.
For the perspective, right. Doug, in 4490, we made a commitment of $15 million. With an initial draw of, I believe it was almost $3 million or a little over $3 million. And rarely does your commitment get entirely used. but that's your potential commitment.
Okay, I got it. Thank you, Jocko. Go ahead.
All right. No, that's fine. So, you know, we're
still smiling about the 30 minutes.
So we're an experienced team. This is our sixth fund. We've been working together as a team for over 20 years. We've had a lot of success over the years. We've had over nine exits. We've had nine exits that had company values of $250 million or greater, all the way up to $1 billion. All Midwestern, mostly university sourced, all in healthcare. Been around long enough doing healthcare that we've really developed deep healthcare networks. We know the entrepreneurs, syndicate partners, the co-investors in these deals. We know the eventual buyers of companies. We're Midwest focused, but with a national reach. And we've got very close relationships, particularly with the University of Wisconsin-Madison and University of Michigan. We're institutionally vetted. All of our funds have institutional backing, including this fund will be backed by State of Wisconsin Investment Board, Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, MG&E, WEA Trust, and a number of others. So we are targeting a first close. We're targeting a $100 million fund, and we're very close to a first closing on the fund. A little bit about the people. I've been a part of venture investors since the mid-'80s, unfortunately, I'm Wisconsin's most experienced venture capitalist at this point. I've been around longer than anybody in this business. I've been involved with a number of big success stories here in the state, including Tomotherapy, Nimblegen Systems, Envirogen, all of which produced big exits for our firm. I've also been really active in the ecosystem here. I serve on the Wisconsin Technology Council, advising the governor and legislature on public policy matters. I'm at the university. I've served a couple terms on the Dean's Advisory Board in the School of Business and on the entrepreneurship program. There. I'm also chairman of the advisory board over at Tandem Press in the School of Education. Jim Addix is our Ann Arbor-based partner. Jim is, we actually met Jim in the late 90s when he was at another fund over in Ann Arbor. And in 2007, we decided to open a fund over in Ann Arbor because of a very similar environment to Madison. We saw a lot of synergy between them. And we asked Jim to join our firm. So we've been co-investing with him for, starting back in 97. And he is actively engaged over at the University of Michigan in a very similar way that we are over here. Scott Button joined us in 1996. Scott is an engineering background like Jim is. Scott is really focused on medical devices and healthcare IT, as is Jim. Scott's had a number of successes, most recently New Wave Medical, which was acquired by Johnson & Johnson for $300 million. We now have number 38 on the Fortune 500 list with a presence in Wisconsin because of that acquisition, and they've grown here in the state. Paul Weiss is here in the room. Paul first got to know us back in 1990 when he worked with us as a intern while getting his MBA and working as a postdoc at the Enzyme Institute at the university. PhD in biochemistry. He left us after that and went off to work for Big Pharma. First up at Scientific Protein Labs making heparin, then went to Wyeth Arist where he had a business development role working with small companies, and then he went to a venture-backed company and brought in the deals that enabled them to go public. And that company was eventually acquired by Johnson & Johnson. We then lured him back to join one of our portfolio companies that was struggling, a company called Gala Design. And he turned that around and successfully sold it to Cardinal Health. And that has been since spun off and is now Catalent and employs how many people over in?
250 this year.
250 people over on the west side of Madison.
Out of curiosity, how does one of your staff people, Paul in this case, turn a company around? Does he go in there and start trying to manage the place or what?
Yeah, he became the CEO. So we recruited him in. He was not part of our firm at that point in time.
Okay, I see.
But he was a friend. He was a member of our investment advisory committee, and we knew his skill sets.
No, I misunderstood. He hadn't gone to work for you yet.
He had worked for us, and then he left, and you know, did a bunch of other things, and then we lured him back. So, and then after 3 years at Cardinal, Paul joined us. Dave Arnstein also was first with us in 2000 as an intern, and then was with us for 4 years, and then went off to join a family business. Which in the Milwaukee area, which they grew from $20 million to over $150 million in revenue. And then our CFO decided to retire, and we lured David back to rejoin the firm. And he's based in Milwaukee, and we're going to open up an office in Milwaukee with this fund. We've also put together a world-class investment advisory committee, a combination of entrepreneurial executives, people like Kevin Conroy and Paul Burns, Fred Robertson, a medical advisors, a number of MDs, PhDs, some great scientists who've been involved with entrepreneurial companies, healthcare administration, venture capital, and some folks from Big Pharma. Bob Smith recently held the position of business worldwide business development for Pfizer and is an old colleague of Paul's from his days at YSR. Some names appear on here twice because they really fit more than one category. So our focus is on healthcare. And, you know, whatever happens in Washington, healthcare is going to be a huge market opportunity for years ahead, largely driven by demographics. As we get older, spending on healthcare triples when you're over 65 compared to 1964. And if you look at the growth of the baby boom bubble, it's going to inevitably push healthcare spending from $3.2 trillion to $5.6 trillion over the course of the next decade. And it's also going to really predictably, there's unmet needs in disease that need to be addressed. So there's clear market opportunities and no shortage of targets for us to go after. Our strategy is to target innovation that's taking place at great research universities in the Midwest. We're obviously in the backyard of two of the biggest and best, University of Wisconsin, University of Michigan. Over the years, we've backed 40 spin-outs from major research, 10 different research universities in the Midwest, disproportionately UW-Madison and University of Michigan. You know, the bulk of the rest of our companies come from the ecosystems surrounding these universities. If you look at University of Michigan and University of Wisconsin, they're the second and sixth largest research universities in the world. Combined research spending of $2.6 billion. They have a disproportionate of that amount of spending is really focused on the life sciences. UW-Madison, for example, $1.1 billion in research spending. $900 million of that is in the hard sciences, $700 million is in life sciences and biomedical engineering. So a tremendous amount of innovation taking place on these campuses, which you know, really needs to see the marketplace in the spirit of the Wisconsin idea.
Go back a minute.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a patent issued and a patent treated?
Oh, patient treated. Well, for some reason, my map didn't show up on this slide. I could see it on the screen here, but it's not up there. So
I can we can go
you can figure it out, though. So
you are here.
If you look, you know, the venture capital is concentrated on the coast, Boston and San Francisco Bay Area, where you have large population centers, huge research spending, concentration of companies and talent. But you look at the Midwest, the institutions within an hour's drive of our offices, and we really end up having more research spending available to us in terms of innovation taking place. And the money that funds this research is in competitive grants from, you know, major granting agencies, mostly federal agencies. And if you look around the Midwest, you know, there's a number of top-tier research institutions, a total of $12 billion in total academic research in our region. There's also a big concentration of companies, so there's a talent pool in the region. The Midwest is really the epicenter of the medical device industry. You think about the Minneapolis area, everybody knows Medical Alley up there. You got Medtronic, St. Jude, 3M, a number of others. Warsaw, Indiana is the epicenter of the orthopedic implant industry. You've got, of course, GE Healthcare in our backyard and medical imaging. We're also the epicenter of healthcare IT. We all know Epic is in our backyard. Cerner's in Kansas City. You've got Merge in Chicago. So there's no shortage of talent within the region to attract into these companies. But the challenge is capital availability. 82% of the venture capital in this country is concentrated in three states. It's managed in three states, California, Massachusetts, and New York. And they deploy 81% of their capital in just three states, California, Massachusetts, and New York. The times they make exceptions to that pattern, they tend to do so in recurring ways, where they developed a trusted relationship with a local co-investor. And for us to be successful at attracting the capital from the coast, it's important to have trusted lead investors that they view as capable peers. And that's the kind of role we serve.
So who are those individuals that provide that 82% money? Are they just very wealthy millionaires, or who are they?
No, the bulk of the industry, bulk of capital in this industry comes from institutions. The biggest investors in the asset class tend to be pension funds, foundations, and endowments. Investors that ultimately have that long-term focus, and you don't get much longer than perpetuity for an organization like a foundation or an endowment. High net worth individual investors are a smaller fraction, but they are an important fraction in the total spending in the sector, or investment in the sector.
So if you have a possible situation for investment, you bring that to these institutions, to pension funds, for example, and you say to the pension fund, here's an idea you want to invest in, the same way you're asking us to invest.
No, the way our industry works is, it's set up as a blind pool. It's really based on our experience to find deals, and we get commitments to our fund, so we're raising a $100 million fund, and then we're being entrusted to go out and find 12 to 15 deals to put that money to work in over the life of the fund.
So I got it backwards. You get the money first and then look for the deal.
Get
a deal and then go look for money.
Right. And by having the backing behind us, it enables us to find the best deals. And with the backing there, we can get the confidence of managers to join these companies because they know there's, some capacity.
And if I remember from past, the $100 million that you accumulate, you don't actually have that. Those are commitments.
Correct. We draw it as we need it and as we find the opportunity.
I got it. Okay, thank you.
In our case, some of our LPs will, once we find an opportunity, they can then co-invest alongside our investment. Yep. They can do a direct investment.
Yeah, so we do get some that do that. So, if you look at the Midwest compared to the coast.
I can't take this call right now.
University research spending is comparable here. In the Midwest, but again, we're lacking in venture capital under management and VC investment.
All right.
This environment has matured. So we've got an ecosystem that's improved with people, ideas, and money, and we're serving as a catalyst to try to be able to use it. Over the years, we've been doing this for long enough where we've generated success stories. Again, we've got 10 companies listed up here that are our big successes. Our most recent big exits were New Wave Medical that Scott Button backed. That was a company developing a cancer treatment using microwave energy that spun out of University of Wisconsin-Madison. We seeded the company. We put about $11 million to work over time. owns 17% of the company at exit, and it was acquired by Johnson & Johnson for $300 million. Another one recently that we exited was Neurovance. This is a deal that Paul found. They were a developer of triple reuptake inhibitors. These are drugs for the treatment of ADHD, which avoid the addiction and abuse problems associated with stimulants. That company was sold to Otsuka for up to $1 billion over time, $100 million up front and the balance in earnouts. And we have a chance to make up to $112 million on our $5 million investment.
Are those earnouts based on revenues generated, or how does that work?
It's a combination. First is clinical milestones. So they were phase three clinical trial ready. And so then the milestones are based upon completion of phase three and launch of the product, and then it's revenue milestones beyond that. So our plan with our Fund 6, $100 million fund, we'll probably put about 50% or more to work in Michigan and Wisconsin, 30% elsewhere in the Midwest, and 20% national. We do the national investments intentionally to develop relationships with the coastal investors, building those bonds, because that's what's really important to help us build the syndicates.
And that's where the money is, as you pointed out earlier.
Yeah, so we need those relationships and be a trusted co-investor. About two-thirds of the companies we back are very early stage, pre-revenue, sometimes right at the formation, where we're doing seed or Series A, and then we participate in every round after that, or that's the goal, until an exit event. And then we're doing a mix of medical device, therapeutics, diagnostics, and healthcare IT, and we've had success in all of those areas. You know, we have a model that has been very effective. We will seed deals very early on, get involved at the very earliest stages. In some cases, it may be professors with a great idea and they don't know where to start, and we will actually help start the company, become co-founders of the company. We will serve as a lead, trying to bring in key management, as we did in New Wave Medical, and then build the syndicate of investors over time. We play a role of networking these deals. Flugen is a company developing a universal flu vaccine, where Paul used his big pharma business development contacts to really understand the opportunity and what it would take to get to a successful exit. Occasionally, we will follow others into deals. We don't lead every deal, but this is particularly true to build those relationships on the coasts. And then, of course, a key one for us is to repeat it. If you've backed an entrepreneur and done very, very well, and they've got a new idea, you've taken a big risk factor out of the equation. You've got people you can have a great deal of confidence in. It's not a guarantee that their next deal will be successful, but you know that what kind of managers they are and what their strengths and weaknesses are, and you can build around that. And we've backed a number of serial entrepreneurs over the years. So we've been doing this for three decades. Our first fund was in 1982, $7.4 million. We returned 3.3 times our investors' money, even though it was set up as a corporation and we had to pay taxes. We went to a more traditional limited partnership format in 1997 with our Fund 2. That fund was probably too small to be successful. We still beat the S&P 500, but we struggled a little bit in the 2001 market downturn where we didn't have the follow-on capacity. We then had two funds that we were managing concurrently, Advantage Capital Wisconsin Partners Limited Partnership, which was a specialized Wisconsin-focused fund, and our Fund 3. Together we had just over $50 million. Those were top quartile performing funds. We beat the S&P 500 by 262 basis points. Did really well for our investors. Our Fund 4, we're in the harvest mode right now. That was a $118 million fund. We've already returned $112 million back to our investors. We have $130 million in escrows and earnouts from companies we sold, where if milestones are hit, we will get it. And then we have 7 remaining portfolio companies, 3 of which are now publicly held. Our Fund 5 was an $82 million fund. That fund is still early. Numerous high potential companies. It's tracking similar to past funds, but still pretty early.
We have a question.
Yeah.
Those are odd numbers for your fund. So what I'm assuming is that you had a commitment that you didn't end up drawing the entirety of.
No, that's kind of just where we ended up in commitments. I mean, it's part of what makes it an odd number is we're putting in 3% of the capital. So
where are you finding that? What?
Well, so
these guys have some skin in the game, Doug.
We have skin in the game. So we're putting in 3% of the money.
So for a $100 million fund,
we're going to put in $3 million.
You're putting in $3 million
of our own money.
Your own personal money,
yes.
For each. Are you like partners in a partnership?
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
So you're
a general partner. As
so
team
partners put in $100,000 or whatever. Okay.
We're going to put in. Well, there's only the 5 of us.
Yeah.
So the 5 of us are going to put in $3 million. So we've got.
Understand.
We've got skin in the game. Our principal objective is return on investment to our investors. But there are some other things we accomplish along the way. And given the mission of the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, I thought it is worth pointing out. I mean, we have a special relationship with the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. We have been the leading backer of UW-Madison spinouts. We've backed 25 companies spinning out of UW-Madison. We are the most engaged venture capital firm in the community, all over campus. We serve on a number of advisory boards on campus. And this has the purpose of not only trying to help, but it helps us get access to opportunities very early on and start the dialogue and develop a relationship with founding entrepreneurs. We are focused where Wharf has the most opportunity. You know, most of the spending on campus is in life sciences, biomedical engineering, and chemistry. We build teams. People like Dan Sullivan, Fred Robertson, Laura King, Lee Edwards, Kevin Conroy, and others, we attracted into our portfolio companies. And, you know, they were the driving force to making those companies successful. And then we build syndicates. You know, we invest in these companies, but then we attract other co-investors into our companies. So in those spin-outs, we have had $672 million invested with or after us in these companies. So, you know, on average, these companies have raised over $25 million apiece, where we were a meaningful participant in each of these companies. We also are not just Madison. We do invest across the state, and with this fund in particular, we've got a Milwaukee initiative. We are going to set up a Milwaukee office. We think there's a lot of opportunity in Milwaukee. You've got the Medical College of Wisconsin, Marquette, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, all sorts of innovation happening in the community. There is a local talent pool, particularly in the medical device space and in biotech. But there's a need in Milwaukee for local investors with experience and capacity in healthcare. The kinds of dollars that are required in healthcare investment are not something angel investors can do. They require $20 to $50 million over their life. And we really are unique in the state bringing that kind of capacity. To justify a Milwaukee office, we really needed some support from the community in Milwaukee. And Aurora Healthcare and Medical College of Wisconsin have agreed to invest in the fund we're asking you to participate in. So that is our story. You know, we are an experienced team focused on healthcare. We're experts at spinning technology out of major research universities. We're here. We've delivered results. We're trying to address underserved market opportunities, and we've got capacity to put the dollars to work and generate returns. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's talk a little bit about we're a public entity.
Yes.
We have open Freedom of Information.
Pressures.
I said, we're a public entity. And we have freedom of information issues. And yet we need to keep proprietary information proprietary.
Yes.
And we discussed that before a little bit. And maybe you can elaborate with our board on how that's going to be dealt with.
Yeah, and we need to become familiar with the protections you've put in place. Certainly the State of Wisconsin Investment Board has taken steps to make sure that our reporting to our investors does not undermine the confidential. We need the freedom to be able to report on the performance of our companies and their achievements without giving away strategic and competitive information
right.
that their competitors could use. And so the State of Wisconsin, legislatively, I know there's been some protections put in place to put this information outside of the reach of FOIA claims. I have to admit I'm not familiar whether you've had similar kinds of protections put in place.
BCPL does not have the same carve-out
okay.
that SWIFT does.
We do have some mechanisms in our reporting to provide some protection where you will get the information from us, but it'll be in a format that does not make it as accessible mm-hmm. to the outside. And, you know, we prefer to utilize those mechanisms. But it'll, you know, we provide thorough reporting, but you know, we do need some protection in that way.
A question, so I call it a cash flow question, for example.
Yeah.
So you're aiming to get $100 million in commitments.
Yep.
You've already got some.
Yep.
How many? Is that private, or can you tell us?
Yeah, no, we're about $56 million
okay.
in commitments right now.
So you're about halfway there. And so on the cash flow question, if we were to commit, let's say, $20 million just to make a round term, and then... How long from the time, say we did that today, which is not going to happen, but just talking, how long would it be until you ask for some of the money, or you don't know for sure?
Yeah, well, it'd be when we, it would, the first draw would be
yeah.
at the moment of our first investment.
But you don't know when that might happen, depending on when you run into
it. It is likely to happen in the next couple months.
So
it could be as early as the end of April.
So there are some professors out there you've already identified. So
yeah, no, we're actively looking at deals, and we're eager to get to a first closing because we've got a pretty rich pipeline of opportunities in front of us.
But for this fund, you haven't done any closings yet?
We have not done any
okay.
closings yet. We are in very late stages of our just negotiating the final limited partnership agreement with SWIB. Actually, SWIB has signed off. We've got a $25 million commitment from them. We have a $10 million commitment from Aurora Healthcare, a $10 million commitment from Wharf. We've got like final little things to get signed off on with Wharf.
So those are in addition to the 50. So you're getting close to the 100 that you want.
Yeah, and
that's
included in the 50.
Right? They're included. So you still got a ways to go. But you might start doing draws before you get to the 100.
We want to do a first closing.
Even before you get
yeah.
to the 100.
So we want to do a first closing on something north of...
So at the same time you're still raising money, you
correct.
Might start spending money.
We will have a one-year window to raise the balance of the dollars.
Okay. Now my question is, so today we committed $20 million, and let's say 4 or 5 months from now you want some of that because you
right.
found a good investment. So you ask us for $10 million, and then you invest that $10 million. And then the company you invest in starts proceeding. It might go belly up, or it might be sold to Johnson & Johnson for
right.
$200 million. When do we get a return?
So, you know, basically as we exit investments, we start generating cash back to you. Our investment.
When you exit, you mean
when the company is sold or when it goes public.
But that could be several years, correct?
It could be several years, and typically it is several years. I mean, you know, the fund is a 10-year life. We have 5 years to kind of pick deals.
Yeah. I'm just trying to put it in perspective
as
a board member who will be asked to commit money. So our $20 million, some of it might go into action within months a return to us of the $20 million plus a profit might be 3, 5, 6 years down the pipe.
Yeah, I mean, if I use the example of our Fund 4, which is in year 12 right now, we essentially have, year 12, coming to the end of year 12, we've returned $112 million on a $118 million fund. So basically, you know, the bulk of money's been returned.
In year 12.
And we have earnouts and escrows for another $130 million.
I remember that, yeah.
And then we have 7 more portfolio companies, which, you know, we're in the process of trying to...
I'm not questioning...
So that fund... I'm trying to see
what our commitment of capital is.
If I could just add, too, the average capital call annually for Fund 5 is about 10 to 12%, just on average. So typically, you may be calling down 10 to 15% maybe annually.
Right.
And maybe by year 7 or 8 or 6, money's just coming back to the investors. So... Most likely not to be 100% exposed on the whole commitment, because typically if you're putting money in, it gets the money, hoping it's the money back. You know, like you said, maybe year 5, 6, 7.
So when we get some money back, does that go into restore our $20 billion commitment?
That money goes back to the investor.
Yeah.
And then we would call additional dollars later on if there's still money out there. So that money would go back to you, unrestricted to the investor.
So when do we reap our profit?
When they make a sale, or when they realize the value of the company at whatever level.
So our fund 4, we're projecting our investors are going to make roughly somewhere between 2 and 3 times their money over the life of the fund. We've got pretty conservative projections that give us great confidence that we're going to get 2 times.
What do you project the life of this fund to be, the new fund that you're starting, number 5?
You know, it's structured with a 10-year life. The nature of these investments or these types of funds is not every deal is exited by year 10.
Yeah.
And usually there is an extension to, you know, harvest the, have us manage every company to exit. And we're, you know, we manage them until the moment where we think we can maximize value.
So in the long run, with your history and our $20 million investment, we might end up with $50
million, yeah,
something like that.
But we
wouldn't have that in hand for 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, you know, our trust fund has got a long-term view.
This
kind of an investment.
I just wanted to get some perspective on the cash flow.
And one more data point for you. Our Fund 3 is a 2000 vintage year, and that returned 1.6 times the investors. So over the time period, we still have 2 companies left that we're still kind of working on. Like John was saying, they're still kind of hanging on. But the investors at this point have got that 1.6 in their pocket, you know, from their investment.
One other question, just because I don't know how you work.
Yeah.
So you have this fund, and you've got $50 million in it, and maybe you'll have, say, $60 million, and then you find an investor, and that investor needs $10 million. Do you draw that equally from all the investors on a percentage basis?
Yes.
Okay.
And if we suppose we close on $60 million or $70 million right now, and we will give ourselves up to a year to raise the balance, and when those new investors sign on, they will have to get caught up to everybody else in terms of the commitment. So that they put in the next dollars, and then they have to pay
an 8%
per annum interest for putting in their money late. So there's a slight little penalty, and that money actually comes back and it goes out to the investors who came in early.
I got it. But it's
pro rata for everybody.
Quite a long-term commitment on our part.
Right.
I got it. Thank you.
Just to remind the board members, our investment policy plan and policy posited that we would put 3% of our investment fund into venture capital. So that would posit about $35 million would be our ceiling right now. That can be changed by the board in the future, but that's what it is today.
This is maybe a silly mathematical question. So let's say the return is 200%.
Okay.
So eventually we would get 40 million back for our 20 million. Am I doing the math right?
Yeah. Well, that'd be 200% absolute dollars in terms of internal rate of return.
Yeah.
You know.
So my question then is, what is our annual percentage?
5 to 10%.
Gained by that.
We would draw about a 5.
No. He's asking about IRR. We target in the teens.
Yeah.
You know, recent funds, I mean, we went through a very difficult decade because of the 2001-2008, but we've been in the, you know, our fund 3 was just under 10%, and that went through both the 2001-2008 downturns. Our 2006 fund, we're at a little over 7%. Of course, that hit the downturn of 2008, so, and that one's tracking. We think we're going to end up in the 9 or 10% one.
Okay.
On that one.
I'm just comparing that to
we target low teens.
To how much we gain if we loan money to a city and they pay us 4%, or you invest in some very clever bonds and we get 5 or 6%.
Right.
So I'm just comparing.
It's a little bit higher expected return with a little longer longer term investment.
Okay.
And risk.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good question.
I'm a question box. That's because I noticed that you've got a bunch of scientists involved. You know, my PhD is organic chemistry.
Oh, okay.
So maybe I'll retire and go to work for it.
Any other questions?
For you? UW could use some good chemistry right now.
What's the biggest things that you've learned over the last couple funds with respect to investing in healthcare companies?
Well, you know, I guess it starts out with the people. It's all about attracting the right experienced people to companies and finding people that, you know, really have a collaborative attitude and want to build world-class teams. And I think that's the thing that takes time to be able to identify the skill sets that you're looking for and the personal chemistry that you're looking for of people who can drive it.
The skill set changes, so you'll have some managements that are much better at the early stage in drug development, but once it's in the clinical testing, you need more of a clinician mindset, so we board or advisors can change that skill set as well. Identify, to John's point, identifying the skill set you need in the
I think the second thing is the importance of creating a boardroom where there's an open dialogue and tremendous transparency and an openness to adjusting the path along the way. A lot of these companies have platform technologies that have more than one application. And often we're heading down the path on the premise that we believe this is the big market opportunity. But it's important that we're listening to the market and listening to what the market is telling us that they really need. And many of these companies find a reaction to what they thought was going to be the second or third thing and are responsive to that and make the adjustment. And I think it's in these entrepreneurial companies, you need to make sure that you're not just sort of blindly heading down the path that you need. I think, you know, the third thing I'd really focus on is just, you know, contingency planning and constantly sort of thinking what's your plan B, what are the risks, you know, trying to manage your dollars really efficiently. Because at the end of the day, this is all of these companies get to their end game through multiple rounds of financing. And it's milestone-based financing. So I'll just use a company developing a drug because it's an easy way to use an example. If a company needs $50 million to get to regulatory approval, you're not going to give them $50 million. You're going to give them $2 million to get to a, you know, IND filing to start a clinical trial, and then you're going to give them enough money to get through their phase one safety trials, and then enough to get through phase two because the possibility that you're going to get negative data along the way. And, of course, you don't want to put all your money at risk. So you become very skilled at trying to, you know, meter that money out
set clear milestones, and then understand, you know, and build in the appropriate buffer of, you know, things never go exactly.
Well, that brings up one of my nasty questions. What percent of the startups that you start up with succeed or just poop out?
Well, no, that's 50-50 or what? It's, you know, we've had a loss ratio kind of in the mid 30s.
Yeah, the industry average is like the low 30s, and the average for our early stage of investing, and we're in that range. We're low 30s of a loss ratio. So about 30% of our companies we invest in will get back less than we invested, you know, 0 to 1 return on capital.
So those companies just don't quite make it and fade away.
And part of our job is to, you know, recoup as much as you can in those scenarios. But then, of course, the flip side, you know, what makes us different than the banker, from the banker's perspective, you know, if a company does moderately well or they become the next Microsoft,
right. They
get their interest back, you know. And from their perspective, their upside is capped, and it seems like their downside is limitless. From our perspective, our downside is limited. We're not going to lose more money than we put into it. But our upside is uncapped. So, like a company like Neurovance that Paul found, and you know, we put $5.4 million in that company, and we're in a position to make $112 million. $112 million on one deal out of a $118 million fund.
Right.
So that fund invested in 18 companies.
Yeah, you hit the mother load very nicely.
Right. And that's happened.
And all of our funds have had that.
All of our funds.
We need that one kind of home run to kind of make the model work. Yeah.
So it's always the top kind of 25% of your deals that drive your own.
The answer to my question is, of 100 entrepreneurs that you latch on to, about 70 go and 30 poop out.
Yeah.
That's kind of what you said.
And of those 70 who make it, you know, some you make a little money and it's really, really hard work, and at the end of the day you go, you know, T-bills would have been easier. But, you know, those companies go on and they create jobs and they have an impact on the community, mm-hmm. and, you know, they do good things, and hey, we made a little money. But they're not the ones driving. They're not enough to make up for the losers. It's that top 25.
So out of the 100, how many really go?
You know, if you can make 10 times your money in 15% of your deals, you're going to have a hugely successful
one. So maybe 15 out of 100 really hit it rich.
Yes. Yeah.
This is kind of fun numbers to know. I mean,
yeah.
When I'm at a cocktail party tonight, I can talk about that. And I know that I have 100 investors, normally about 30 poop out, 15 hit it rich.
And you know, I mean, it is why investing in this space, you need to do it for fun. Right. And, you know, that's the whole game of venture capital. It's where angels have challenges sometimes because they don't spread across enough deals. If they're lucky enough to hit on one, great. But, you know, and the other old adage in the industry is that the lemons ripen quicker than the plums. So, you know, if things don't go well, we know that quicker. You know, so the lemons, they just, you know, the goal is to see that, you know, fast to fail before we put too much money. But the real successes take a great deal of time to mature.
Good. Well, you're very helpful. Thank you.
I don't have too many questions. I appreciate your time. So do we have a dollar amount that you're generally looking for? And then you had mentioned a couple of the other institutional investors like SWIB, Wharf.
Yes.
So you said SWIB is looking at $25 million,
yes.
And Wharf is on 10.
Yeah.
Do you know, one of the things that, it's just, you know, we're not as big, obviously. They're $100 billion, we're a billion, whatever. Do you know about ballpark what SWIB does total venture capital? Are they in the 3% that we're aiming for?
I think they're in that. I think they're actually a little bit higher overall in venture capital than that.
So they might have $3 billion-ish total?
Yeah. Wharf is certainly bigger than that in venture capital in total in terms of percentage.
Because they do a higher percentage because their research just how they work.
Yeah, and they still do it within the normal realm, but they're pretty...
What is WRF, I know you don't work for, but like ballpark, what do they have? If we're a billion, where's WRF at about?
They're about a $3 billion foundation, but they're investing in venture capital nationally.
They do the coast and here and everywhere. Okay.
Right.
Well, my only concern, you guys seem, it sounds all good, and I appreciate it. I like that it's local and all that good stuff, but I'm assuming this is similar to going to be the 10, 15 million range somewhere, similar to the other group we did.
Well, we're capped by our plan.
Yeah.
Okay. 30 was a good number.
No, I heard that.
You didn't hear that? What?
They liked your 30 million.
30 was a good example.
You go 40, it's just from a number perspective, it's a lot more of our fund as a percentage, because we basically would have all of our venture in two funds, whereas WRF being three times our size, it's just something to look at that way.
Well, look, we're trying to help the state in more than one way, and certainly the state benefits in ways that other investors don't. Mm-hmm. Our success stories, create jobs. They create tax revenue for the state. They help, attract people into the state. Create high-paying jobs. The average job is...
Which, to your point, would make more sense in theory of a state organization investing here versus we just wanted to throw our $25 million into the coast.
Right.
They're most likely investing over in Boston or wherever.
Exactly.
It would be just a rate of return, hopefully, only.
I mean, the point you were making is that our $15 million invested is a bigger percentage of our fund than either WRF or SWIB is. Is that a problem in your mind?
We have to invest somewhere. I'm just asking. It was just a dollar amount.
Well, that 3% target that we have in the investment policy is for funds actually called already. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to take a number of years for all, let's say that it's $15 million for that money to be actually called. And so we could actually commit more than the 3% because we're never going to really get there.
Well, and the only other problem is it's not like the venture capital people are looking to get $2 million or $1 million. It's not worth your time. So
to your point, I believe our Fund 4, because of distributions we were making before all the capital was called, I think it was like a 68% was the sort of the maximum exposure relative to the commitment.
Yeah, I've heard a rule of thumb of maybe 60%.
Yeah, you have to
overcommit
to actually hit a target because the dollars come flowing before they...
One other question. There's been five funds, or is this going to be six? I can't remember.
This is our sixth.
This will be six. And so of one through five, I saw the S&P 500. We think on average most of them beat the S&P.
Yeah.
Say, of the five, four, three, or four of them, like most of them.
They all have, mm-hmm. except our Fund 5 is early, and so we just don't have...
But the other previous ones did?
Yeah.
That's a good sign.
Yeah.
I'm looking at our accountant back there, Denise, and we'll have reporting as to the estimated value of the investment on a regular basis.
Yes, we publish quarterly reports with details on your capital accounts and the allocation, full financial statements, allocation of all gains, all the realized and unrealized losses. And then we do we adjust all of our valuations on a quarterly basis, adjust it to market value. Sometimes market value is difficult to determine just because of the illiquid nature of the investments. We tend to be pretty conservative in how we do it, and then that is oversight. There is oversight on that from our limited partners on an annual basis when we do a much more thorough review of the valuation and send a full report that needs to be approved by our limited partners.
And John,
that leads me to a question. To do all this, how big a staff do you have? Do you have 20 people working, 30 or 50 or what?
Dave is the power.
I do it all,
No, there's five of us that are partners. Then we have a controller, and then we have a part-time assistant. We are going to add a couple people.
And that's it? You don't have a staff of clerical people and bookkeepers and everybody?
That covers it.
Well, we have, I'm the CFO of the fund. We have a controller and an office manager. Then we've got, four investment partners, basically, that are doing the deals and taking the board positions.
And that's
we also have an accounting firm, BDO, does our audit.
Okay.
And they come in the end of the year and work very closely with us on the valuation. So they approve the valuations also and apply on the valuation, as well as the LP committee also. So the process.
I just envisioned with your fingers in so many pies out there, I thought it'd be a lot of people to keep track of all that.
Well, each of us can manage about a half a dozen portfolio companies at any given moment.
And you serve on the board on some of them.
Most of them. It's almost always we're serving on the board, and if we're not on the board, we're at least in the boardroom as observers.
So you're kind of limited in the sense that you have to self-limit.
You guys work pretty hard.
Yeah, well, we get companies to exit, and then it opens up bandwidth. And right now, Paul had some exits last year. Scott just had some exits, so we all have bandwidth right now for meetings.
The early stage companies, one of these is good to have a technical background because we're really part of the operation as they craft a strategy. So it's a really hands-on effort, certainly in the early stages of these early stage companies.
Plus you maintain an advisory committee of experts throughout the field.
We get a lot of help from the outside. We bring in patent counsel to help review the patents before we make investments. So, we'll engage consultants to help us assess opportunities. But we keep pretty lean as we
want. Why don't I keep you forever? I've got to go back to my office. Jonathan, you're boss.
I'm good. This is our second meeting with him, and I learn every time we get together with him. Maybe a third meeting, isn't it?
So, before I run off, from your perspective, anything you need from us that you haven't already got from all my questions?
Candidly, it's important to us to have you guys on board.
Well, this is excellent. It was very educational. I appreciate it.
I will say, one of the challenges in the Midwest is there isn't as much capital available. And, when you get in a place like Wisconsin, we need our institutions to step up and be involved. Because, these companies just go off to the coast looking for money, or we go off to the coast. First thing that we get asked is, well, what are the local institutions doing? And if we in the state who know what the opportunities are, who know the quality of the institutions like the University of Wisconsin, who know the drive of our entrepreneurial people, if we're not getting behind them, why should anybody else?
That makes sense. So the investors you've mentioned are all nonprofits. Do you ever get investments from profit-making
companies? Aurora Healthcare is a not-for-profit. Yeah. MG&E is an investor.
Okay, yeah.
So WEA Trust is an investor. Medical College of Wisconsin, that's actually out of their foundation. Then we have some high-net-worth individuals who invest. So we've got a number of individual investors.
Okay.
You could join a dog.
That's right.
You can hit him up twice.
I can write you a check for $10,000. That helps.
That's why you get the odd numbers, because you have individual investors that are about $10,000.
You'll make up the $30 million.
Okay.
Sell
all
right.
Well, before we end, we have to actually have a motion to adjourn the meeting. One of you guys.
That's right.
The
Attorney General has left.
He left around 2:30.
And then I'm on the record here now. This is Doug. I'll make a motion that we adjourn.
I'll second the motion.
All in favor say aye.
Aye, aye.
2-1. 2-0. Okay, we're adjourned.
Two people.